Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 7, delivered on September 13, 2016. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, the time value of money. Sir, I should like to borrow $100 from you. I'll pay you back in a year. Is that okay? You give me $100 and I'll give you $100 back in 1 year. How's that sound?
I'd like to read this.
Well, you capitalist running dog, you. You want to make interest. Oh, okay.
Well, if we're friends, then maybe not. But.
Well, we're not just friends. We're bros. I mean, there's maybe even a bromance in this.
Well, then sure, of course.
Oh, yeah. No, you gotta hold your capitalist slide on this. Look, we charge interest on money. Now, understand that there are systems that don't charge interest, that don't use the concept of, don't instrumentalize lending. And I might have already told you this, but a couple of years ago, there was a memo came around. Professors, well, we should probably start teaching a little bit about maybe a course in alternate finance systems. And before I could even answer, there was all this batting back and forth about such systems as Islamic finance, maybe a course in it or a mini course, something like that. And I said, do you really want to go there? Because it gets complicated because a lot of Western finance and economics types say there's no real, if Islamic finance is no different, even though they say they don't charge interest, they really do. That fundamentally, that's a misunderstanding. Islamic finance is essentially in very much like the Judaic finance system in that there was the concept of interest is considered to be an evil, a wrong. And there has to be another way to keep capital flowing from the surplus economic agents, those who have it, to the deficit economic agents, those who need it. But without interest, there has to be a fundamentally different mechanism. Fortunately, they dropped the idea because that would have drawn you students into a very complex world. Understand this, though. That you really should learn about these types of finance where interest rates don't exist. Because, for example, some of the very most powerful moneyed economies on earth use Islamic finance, not Western capitalist finance. But I can't teach you that, so I'm going to just teach you interest, the interest rate that is concepts and all of that that are part of our finance system, and leave that to you for you to worry about some other time. I'm almost thinking of having an Islamic finance scholar speak to my economics club so that they can get an idea of how this works. But look, at the heart of it, why are you going to charge me an interest rate?
Are we friends again?
Well, no, we're friends, but still, you've got to make a buck. But why do you want to make a buck off this money I'm lending you? Why?
Because if I didn't give it to you, I should be investing it in something else.
I love it when you talk dirty. You're talking about opera. It shows you what my life is like. In other words, you're talking about an opportunity cost.
Yeah.
An opportunity cost. In other words, you're giving up something. By me having the money, you don't have it. You could use that money. Heck, you could buy a friend. Or, well, at least rent one for a... No, you could get a cheeseburger. You see, the thing is that at the heart of all... Now, there are a lot of pieces to an interest rate, and I'm going to go through that a little bit with you here. You should have had this happen to you in economics, and I'll bet you didn't in your econ course. So I'm going to do it here. But at the heart of all interest rates is this core. this tiny interest rate that represents the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Opportunity cost, and this marker sucks. Cost, seriously, of foregone. I'm fading fast here, consumption. Is there some reason my life sucks right now? Someone copped the marker I was hiding, and so I'm left. Yeah. Anyway, opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Now, there are other things that can carry on with an interest rate. They pile up one after the other after the other. Matter of fact, if I had a sheet of paper, I might even be able to write this down. Nope, don't have a sheet of paper either. So, anyway, that usually is a small interest rate. It's actually, at the core of it, this is a tiny interest rate, usually. Sometimes it gets very big. Oddly enough, there have been a couple of times in just the last 5 years, I guess, where it actually became a negative value, briefly. And that was something we also saw in the depths of the Great Depression, as the Fed was printing money hand over fist. Sometimes that opportunity cost of foregone consumption can go negative. K, real. The real interest rate. Real, down there. God, I wish I had a mark. A decent marker. Anyway, wait, I got an idea. Let me try this. Bear with me one moment here. Word. I could do this. Okay. I'm just going to put it as an R. Okay, now. That's the real interest rate. It is driven by supply of and demand for money. On top of that are other interest rate pieces that add on. The most important of them is that is at the core. It's part of the core. Is this expected inflation premium? Now let me go through this. Let me explain this one to you, okay? Madam? I hired you a year ago. I'm a generous employer. I am paying you your full time, and I am paying you $100 a week. I know. I mean, let's good times roll. $100 a week, okay? So you come in for your first annual review. And I say, well, you've done such a darn good job, I am going to give you a raise. Let's see, last year the inflation rate was 2%. So I'm going to give you a 2% raise. So you have $102 every week for the coming year. Now get back to work, slave. Okay, so you go, yep, I got my 2%. Right off the bat, you think right there, I have already wronged her. I have already cheated her right away. But there's a second part that's happening. Okay. Now, you come in for your second annual review. Well, you're still doing great. I mean, I'm impressed with you. So I'm going to give you, it looks like the inflation rate last year was 4%, so I'm going to give you a 4% raise. Okay? So you've now got a 4% raise. Okay, you go back to work. Next year, you come in, I say, well, still doing great. Last year, inflation was 6%, so I'm going to give you a 6% raise. Okay? Now, there are two reasons that I am cheating you. The first one is that it was that first year, 2% had already eroded your purchasing power. When I give you 2%, you've already taken the shock of the 2% price rise. And now you're going into the next year having been damaged by the 2% price increase already. That's the first reason. It's a little bit subtle, but now, the second reason. It was 2% last year, so I gave her 2%. It was 4% last year, I gave her 4%. It was 6% last year, I gave her 6%. So you come in this year and I say, well, it looks like inflation last year ran 8%, so what are you going to? I'm going to give you an 8% rise. And you look at me and you say, no, you hog face. You're going to give me 10%. Why, you greedy person. Bet you belong to a union or something. Why is she going to want 10%? Because it's the expectation that matters. History is dead. It's gone. It is over. It's like that book by Stephen King some years back, and they even made a movie out of it called The Langoliers. These people got stopped in time. Time was still going forward, but they got stuck. And they realized that there was some horrible thing that they could hear eating around them, along the walls on the outside, the world around them. They're called the Langoliers. They eat the past. And they were going to catch up with them because these people were not going forward. The Langoliers eat the past. Stephen King was sort of hinting at this whole concept that our history, we can't even establish that history existed. Well, we can't. It's really tough. It requires some incredible math. But the point is, for finance, we don't give a rat's butt about what has happened. And you should not. I can guarantee you that when a bank charges you an interest rate, they are putting in an expected inflation premium for the future, not for what has already happened. Inflation is tame right now. Every one of us knows that inflation is going to set loose. Sooner or later, it's going to come at us. And we're building into it right now, low probability, far out there in expected inflation premiums. But as it gets closer, as that time gets closer to us when we start facing terrible inflation, it's going to start showing up in our interest rates. That was one of the real disasters that happened at the end of the 1970s. You see, we came out of the era of Dwight Eisenhower, ending the 1950s. He had this, you know, slow growth, not too much money for social programs, not too many tax cuts for the rich. He was a very moderate kind of guy. And then you came in with this can-do, brash, modern man named Jack Kennedy, who saw all of these possibilities for the future. On one hand, backing down the communist threat that was beginning to spread across Asia, and, of course, the Soviet Union. Programs for social programs and all of this kind of stuff. And so we began this process of printing money ahead of ourselves. Now, for a long time, you can print money and it doesn't show up as inflation. So Lyndon Johnson, after Kennedy, did it. Nixon tried to bring it under control, but by the end, once that oil price shock, when the OPEC shut off the oil supply because we were supporting Israel, and we had supported them in a rather humiliating war for the Arabs, they shut off the oil supply, so oil prices skyrocketed. So Nixon's Fed cranked up the money supply, and every time inflation began to eat away at the real growth this money was doing. So they just upped the printing of the money to a higher rate. And that would help the economy for a while, but then that help would absorb, disappear into inflation. Gerald Ford knew there was a problem, so he started this program called Whip Inflation Now, WIN, to stop inflation, which of course meant nothing because they were still printing money hand over fist, so inflation was getting embedded faster and faster. Carter came into office and he tried to frame it as a moral issue. He said, I see this as the inflation as the moral equivalent of war. M-E-O-W, meow. Oh, that went over real well. So Carter in 1979 appointed a man who just doesn't care about human life to the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker. Volcker just crushed the money supply down. Supply of money goes down, price of money, interest rates went through the roof. But there was already this massive expected inflation premium, and no one believed Volcker was going to hold on. So the expected inflation premium just kept getting worse and worse. Ah, Volcker's going to print money like all of them did. And at the same time, money was disappearing from the economy, so interest rates, real interest rates, were skyrocketing. The supply of money was going down. So you had interest rates in that period where you had home loans at 25, 30%, corporate bonds at 30, 35% coupons. It was insane. Finally, after throttling the economy for about 2 years, the financial markets, oh, you mean business. And so the expected inflation premium began to bleed back out. But it took a long time. That's the problem. Once the expectation is embedded, it's going to take a lot of time to soak it out. And finally, the economy was just in a shambles. Carter was kicked out of office by the Republican nominee, a man named Ronald Reagan. But the economy finally began to come back to its feet in 82, 83. Expected inflation was down. Then Volcker let off the money supply. He started allowing the money to grow again. So K sub R went down, the real interest rate. And so this animal right here, you see this thing? The real interest rate plus the expected inflation premium is called the risk-free rate. That is the risk-free rate. Understand that these two components, we actually can't see them. They are tangled together so intimately that it's a theoretical construct. It's very much like in quantum mechanics, where we have to create a theoretical model of what is happening below the level of the neutron and the proton. So we use the model of these subatomic particles called quarks and leptons. It doesn't matter whether they really exist or not. They make the model work. And that's what we do in finance, too. The risk-free rate is actually also just a model as well. By the way, sometimes we designate this as K sub F. The risk-free rate. Now, if you have to watch me. I still use interest rates with R's sometimes, but apparently you're supposed to use K's these days. The risk-free rate is a theoretical animal, but we can see a proxy of it. A very short-term treasury bill, its yield is about the risk-free rate. We know that it's probably not exactly it, but it's as close as we can get. So if you want, and you will see in our finance, we have models that are very powerful that we use all the time that call for us to use the risk-free rate. We have to. So because we don't have the actual thing, we use the proxy of a short-term treasury bill yield to do this. Okay? Now, so that's the first interest rate we might be able to see with our own eyes. But remember that its two pieces are being driven by forces. The Federal Reserve is part of that major force, but also global demand for money can cause this thing to do weird things as well. Remember that story I told you about what happened to the Bank of England with George Soros? That was all driven by interest rates going up in one country in this exchange rate mechanism. That country was Germany. Germany in the 1990s, early 1990s, the Berlin Wall fell, so they had the West Germany brought East Germany back in. It was just like a basket case. East Germany had investment had just collapsed years before. Housing, food, distribution, transportation, industrial manufacturing, they were all shot to hell. And so West Germany had to borrow buttloads of money, huge amounts of money, to finance rebuilding East Germany. And hence, German case of R, like that, through the roof, which of course made its currency very powerful, very strong, and of course Britain's currency, relatively speaking, in the exchange rate mechanism, just dropped through the floor. Hence, going for the jugular, as George Soros did, because Great Britain kept trying to hold on, jack its interest rates up, sell its gold to try to buy its own currency to keep it in the band against the Deutschmark. Didn't work. Okay. Enough about that. Now, the problem is that we now go to K sub F plus something called the risk premium. I don't think I've ever done it this way before. It's not the greatest thing. Okay, K sub F. We got that one. The risk premium has three pieces to it. Three pieces. There is a default premium, a maturity premium, and an illiquidity premium. We'll reduce the size of that. I'll bring that down now. Let me explain. The default premium. There is a chance that you won't pay me back if I lend you money. Now, you probably are a very good guy, but I don't trust you. However, you collateralized your loan. So that makes it less risky for me. So even if there is a default, I would not put much of an interest rate on, extra interest rate on. Maybe 100 basis points, 200 basis points. 100 basis points is 1%, okay? However, you, madam, you are an untrustworthy soul. A credit card I gave you, so there's a good chance if you will default to begin with, and there's a good chance I will get nothing back if you do default. So I would have a very high default premium on that loan. Let's try a couple of others. What would you say, ma'am, would you have a big default premium or a small default premium, let's say, on a car loan? You said small? It's fairly small, but the problem is when you buy like a new car, you ever heard that rule that as soon as you drive it off the lot, it loses money, it loses value? So there would be some default premium because even though if you defaulted, I could get the car back, it would have lost some of its value just because you drove it around and you ate White Castle cheeseburgers in it and things like that, which made it nasty. Okay? But still not a horrible default premium. How about a home loan? Would a home loan have a high default premium, sir, or a low default premium? Is it collateralized or not? A home loan. You haven't borrowed money for a home yet, have you? Okay, that's kind of an unfair question then. What would you say? It would be very, very small, because a home loan is collateralized by an agreement. A home loan is a bond. There is an annex to it, a second document, which is called a mortgage. And the mortgage guarantees that if you don't pay, they get the home. Now, here's a little secret story about that. These banks were screaming and blubbering because all of these people defaulted during the crisis, 2008 and after that crisis. We're losing so much money on these homes. No, they weren't. Well, the home values had fallen. That doesn't matter, because most people have no idea that when they take out a home loan, part of their payment is to pay an insurance premium to make the lender whole for the difference between the value of the house and the value on the face value of the loan. In other words, you pay the interest so that the bank doesn't lose on your loan. And most people don't know that. And the journalist writing, well, these banks really suffered because of all these bankruptcies. No, they didn't. They were insured, and the insurance premiums had been paid by the people who lost their home. Isn't that an interesting thing? Most people have no idea that's going on. Interestingly, a second part of that is that almost, I saw a number on this. It was just amazing. A bank cannot require you to pay that insurance premium once the loan value goes below 80% of the value of the property, value of the house. They have to back it off. But you have to tell them to. So a lot of people ride their whole loan clear down to the ground, pay it off, and they have been paying an insurance premium that they didn't have to pay for most of the life of that loan. Just didn't know it. But anyway, default premium on a home, notwithstanding what bankers might tell you, it should be a very low number. Okay, I brought up a couple of other ones. Credit cards would be a high one. Go. Afterwards, well, it would perform at that point where they defaulted. The insurance would perform because the banker would seize the property. All right, they still owe $120,000. The value of this home is $90,000. The MAGIC, Mortgage Insurance Guarantee Company, would cover the delta right there at that point. So it would be essentially, it's a wash to the lender, although there are costs. You got to appreciate that. It's not nearly what they fashioned it as in the media with their media storm about it. But basically, if you were the one who defaulted, you paid the insurance premiums and you got nothing except evicted and out on the street and the bank was made whole. So there's a little bit of an unfairness in there that's very difficult to justify. That you covered their butts, they kicked your sorry ass out of the house, and they walk away. And so do you. I recommend there are a couple of bridges in Chicago where the wind doesn't blow through too hard in the winter, but, you know, that's a personal preference. Watch out for Florida. The gators come and eat the homeless people. Here's the next one, a maturity premium. This is a nasty one in the sense that this is one that goes against the lender, whether interest rates go up or down. So the more uncertain interest rates are, or the longer the loan is, the bigger this maturity premium will be. Again, let me say that again, just to make sure you get it. The more uncertain interest rates are, in other words, more volatility, or the longer the loan is, the bigger this premium is. Because whether interest rates go up or down, the lender is hurt and the borrower is helped. That's why it is such a good idea to have interest rates stable. And that's one of the bad things about a Federal Reserve that is ordered by act of Congress to play with money to help and hurt the economy. They shouldn't be doing that because ultimately they create an uncertainty about future interest rates that might not be so necessary. Here's the deal. Okay. And I'll use the example of a home loan. Most people, on average, you will hold a property, a home loan, a house, for 7 years before you move on. You got your starter home on the east side of Decatur. It was a modest trailer, house trailer. But after 7 years, you've been listening to Bruce Springsteen songs and that one about gotta stay hungry, gotta move on and all that, got a wife and kids in Baltimore, Jack. You know, I've always wondered why that son of a bitch got by with that. He should have been shot for that song. Anyway, listen, you gotta move on. You gotta get bigger. I'm gonna get me a double wide trailer. Cause I got me a lot of extra stuff I've been picking up at flea markets and things like that. And plus I got 7 kids now, okay? Hold the home on average 7 years. That's the typical thing. Okay, now, let's try something. His interest rate, the mortgage interest rate, was, let's say, 8%. Now, looking for someone who might actually, I got to be a little careful here because most of you aren't experienced with the loans themselves, but you might know what's going on. Sir, suppose that interest rates drop to 4%. Now, he's got that nice little trailer of his. It's only year three, but interest rates have dropped to 4%. His loan is at 8%. Mortgage rates have dropped to 4%. What will he do? You're getting there. Go ahead. He'd refi that son of a dog. He will refi it instantly. You see, because he's paying 8%. He's not going to say, well, I'm paying 8%. No, if mortgage rates go to 4%, he's going to refinance that loan immediately. Or he's just going to buy a new trailer right away. Instead of 7-year hold, which the bank would be calculating its future expected cash flows from, he surprises them and he tanks out at 4 years because interest rates have fallen. Me, I'm the banker. I was expecting 8% from him for at least 7 years. And suddenly, he's paid me off. He's refied, and now I've got that money back, and I can reinvest it now, not at 8%, but at the current rate of 4%. So I am screwed in this deal because interest rates dropped. And he did the rational thing, which was to refi. Do you follow the logic here? If interest rates fall, I, the lender, get kicked in the rear end. Now let's take it the other way. I haven't seen someone I haven't picked on in a while. Madam, he's at year 7, moving into year 8, getting antsy, gotta move, gotta stay hungry, I gotta take off, get on the road, get a bigger house trailer, and me and a Ford F-250 so I can pull it around. Okay, interest rates skyrocket to 16%. He's paying only 8% on his loan. Is he going to now sell that home and get a mortgage at 16%? Oh, hell no. He's going to keep that. He'll just add on. There's a lot of cardboard Walmart throws out that can be laminated. And you know what we're talking about. You know, the Florida room, the deck, you know, doghouse, room for the kids. Cardboard. You got to get the stiff stuff because the kids kind of bounce around and they can bend it. Okay. Ow. Okay. Now, here. You see what's happening? If interest rates went down, me, the banker, if interest rates go up, at 7 years, I was expecting him to refi, to get out from under it, and I could do what I wanted with the money. But I hope he pays off that loan because now I can get 16% for him. Oh, heck no. He's not going to do that. He's got 8% in a 16% loan environment. He's going to keep that thing forever. That's what he's going to do. So you see, whichever way interest rates go, I am adversely affected. So if interest rates, I as a banker am looking out there and I see interest rates being volatile, I see that there's a period of uncertainty in the future, I'm going to add a maturity premium that is pretty stiff, because either way interest rates would go in that volatile future, I am hurt as a lender. If I see a stable world, a stable economy, a Federal Reserve that doesn't jerk around interest rates, a federal government that doesn't jack up tax rates or drop tax rates, that doesn't go on insane adventures that drive us into massive budget deficits which drive up interest rates. If I see a world where everything, interest rates have a high probability of stability, I will have a low maturity premium. In our world as it exists now, the maturity premium is fairly robust. It's not that small, because we know sooner or later the Fed's going to have to jack up interest rates, because it's just been shoveling money into the economy for the last 8 years. We know very well that we're facing a very difficult time after the election, whoever is elected. We've got some major problems that we have put our heads in the sand. All that. So the maturity premium is pretty nasty. Well, not, I shouldn't say that. It's stronger than I've seen it at other times in my life. Now the last one, illiquidity premium. Illiquidity. Okay. Madam, you're a wealthy person. Now, you have friends, and you lend them money from time to time. Now, one of your friends is this fine, upstanding citizen. Comes from a sterling family, and he needs some working capital for a year. Just some working capital. And he borrows on a promissory note, actually a promissory bill, for a year, $1,000. Okay, actually, he's going to promise to pay you back $1,000. So you'll discount, maybe give him $980, and he pays you back. You make $20 on $980 investment. Okay, he's got this nice, he had his lawyers, his dad's lawyers make up a document, wherefores and thou arts, and the gold filigree, and all that. Okay. You'll lend him $980, your price of his bill. He's the issuer of a bill. You're the buyer of the bill, meaning you're the lender. You lend him $980 and get a face value of $1,000. Okay, now, you have this old guy you know. He was once a professor of finance at this public university in a small Midwestern city. You hadn't seen him in years, and one day you're walking around in Chicago on the Miracle Mile, and the wind is blowing, and this old geezer comes up to you.
Ew, I know you. Oh, be darn, what was your name? Never mind, your name doesn't matter. My name is Professor C. You remember me? Hey, listen, I've read about you. You're rich. I need some money. Can you lend me some money? I'll pay you back $1,000 in 1 year. As a matter of fact, let me write it down. I got this old marker that didn't work when I used it in that stupid class, and now I've still got that damn thing. Where can I write this down? Oh, I got it here. I probably don't want to use the other side of this because it's kind of nasty. Yeah, it's hard to find a public bathroom around here. I owe you $1,000. I'm going to sign it. This is a bill, and you pay me a price for it, and you get $1,000 back. Here's your damn thing. Oh, stop acting so funny. It's the other side. Oh, God. Okay. Concentrate, damn it.
What are you going to lend me? $980?
$980.
Oh, are you out of your mind?
I'm going to leave. I'm not going to pay you back. Even worse, though, you see, if you really needed the money you'd lent him, you could sell that to any respectable person. You could sell it to him for $980, maybe $975. But if you needed this money back from me before it was over, I mean, does he look stupid? He's not going to buy this. You're not going to buy this. I mean, you're not even going to touch it. I don't know why I am. Do you see how dirty this thing is? Okay, here's the deal, though. That means that there is an illiquidity premium on that mine. You see, she will lend me... will you stop? It's not... That was kind of... What the... Okay, the deal is that illiquidity premium, and I'll tell you about this in my professional life, illiquidity premium, essentially, for the possibility that a lender can't get out from under the debt early. You see, because some things, I mean, look, you borrow money for a home within minutes sometimes. That loan has been sold to these massive, mega, global entities like Ginnie Mae and all that, Freddie Mac and all that. The banks don't keep your loan. They sell it instantly. They get rid of it. They are not in the business of doing that. They get a fee for servicing the loan, give you the facade that this is the bank that lent me the money. Well, they got rid of that thing as fast as they could. They bundle them up into these packages of loans. Then they sell them to these secondary mortgage markets, and the secondary mortgage markets just buy them without blinking an eye. That was one of the things with those high-risk loans that were being made to people, poorer people and working-class people, is that the secondary mortgage markets were just buying them up really fast, not noticing these things are not high-grade, high-investment grade. But here's where this comes hits home to me. When I was in, years and years ago, I ran a penny stock house. I was the principal of it. And we had these really, I mean, low-end stocks. I mean, just absolute dog stocks. And what would happen is people would say, well, you know, I bought this in a little public offering for $2.50. And I'll say, well, okay, I'll buy those 100 shares you've got for $1 each. Of course, they'd be, are you out of your mind? What are you guys talking about? I have no idea where I'm going to sell those. I've got to find a sucker who's going to buy this crap that from me. So, you see, there's a huge illiquidity premium if it is not traded on a major exchange like the NASD, the AMEX, the NYSE, or at least a regional exchange or a European exchange. That was the problem, was that in this penny stock world, I mean, these people would be furious because I would not pay much at all for their stock, and then they'd have a cow because, well, I paid in a public offering a lot more than that. Yeah, well, that's because you were stupid, weren't you? And then I started to explain to them the greater fool theory, which really I've gotten in trouble for telling you guys the greater fool theory, but I'll tell you anyway. The whole trick with buying and selling stock is that first, you have to assume that you were a fool for buying that stock. You don't say I'm a genius or I do day trading or I took Professor C's course. No, you were a fool for buying equity. You're a fool. Now, the next step is once you've gotten past that reality, you need to find a greater fool. A fool who is greater than you, who will buy it from you at a higher price than you bought it. That's the whole thing with stock, is in order to be successful, you have to find a greater fool than you are, and you are a fool for playing in the stock market. God, I know that's going to bite me back in the butt someday, again, telling that. Okay, now. So, this is why we see all kinds of different interest rates. When I say the interest rate, well, there are a lot of different interest rates because interest rates, all of them have that case of Beth, that substrate, sitting there at the bottom.
Some have, I'll tell you about that in a minute. But different interest rates carry different balances of the three dimensions of the risk premium. Some will have low on all of them. Like a treasury bill has pretty much a very short-term treasury bill is zeroed out on default maturity and illiquidity. But, for example, a treasury bond, it's not going to default. It's a government issue. It's, you can sell it in a blink of an eye. It has no illiquidity premium. But because it's a long instrument, it carries maturity premium. And that's where I'll show you the next thing here. This is kind of a setup lecture here. Bear with me one moment. No, I didn't want to do that. Okay, let me try this. I can never remember the URL of this place. Okay. It's something called like stock charts. Is that it? There it is, the Dynamicon. Love this thing. Let me show it to you. Now I'm going to teach you how to see the future, at least through a dark window. Never mind this one on the sys side. This thing right here, this little puppy, this is called a yield curve. It shows the yields of different government debt issues by their maturity. So, for example, this would be an extremely short, the one at the axis would be an extremely short-term treasury bill. That would be K sub F. I don't know, can you see that here? Let me see if I can blow it up some more. Okay, right there, about K sub F, a very short. And then as you go out through time, you see that the interest rate is going up. Like, for example, a five-year treasury note would have a yield up here. A 20-year treasury would have a yield up here. A 30-year, we actually weren't issuing 30 years for some time, would have a yield just above about 2.32%, 2.33%, something like that. That's right now. That's real time. Now, here is the fun part, is to watch how a yield curve behaves through time. So let's look at the trail length. Take it clear out to here. Okay, so now, you see the dark? That is the trail out. It should be like, that should be almost a year, I think. Now watch what's been happening to the treasury, the yield curve. Let's bring it back in. Notice that it was very stable for months. But then, well, look at that. You see how it's beginning to arch? You see how the maturity premium is going up out here on this part right here? You see it? Again, watch. This is many months ago. Now we're going to pull it back. See how it was stable? Stable. And then suddenly, very recently, that it's begun to have that kick upward. The maturity premium is beginning to increase strongly, especially in the out years. In other words, there is an expectation of volatility beginning to embed in there. Possibly there's a changing expectation of inflation too, but most of that is an expectation of inflation. Now I'm going to show you something else. There is a kind of yield curve. You look at yield curves and you say, is this a healthy yield curve or is this an unhealthy yield curve? Now this one, still pretty healthy. It was actually a little unhealthier a while back. I'm going to show you something here. At this point right here, you had a nasty problem developing, a kink. This is a healthy yield curve. one that has a gentle upward slope to it, like that. If it slopes too much upward, that's probably a sign that there's inflation compound, expectation of inflation compounding in it. Okay, like that. But there's something that can happen. Every recession has been preceded by what I'm going to show you. Every recession has been preceded by what I'm about to show you. However, not every one of them has followed with a recession. It's called an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve, and I really want this to work one more time for me. An inverted yield curve, right at the freaking end. No, those aren't inverted, you hoe handle. Oh. They're not even showing an inverted yield. Oh, here it is. Is that an inverted? No. You moron. Okay. Anyway, let me back off here. I thought I could show you one here. No, that's not an inverted yield curve. Investopedia figures. Okay, an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve is... Is that real marker? Is that a dry erase? You lie. I don't care. I'm going to put it over here. Oh, it is. You had that all along? That's an inverted yield curve. It kinks downward. Every recession has been preceded by one of those. Every recession. Now, here's what was going on in the spring of 2008. My articles, I kept warning, doomsday is here, the zombie apocalypse is on the horizon and all that. I'm sure there were a lot of very reputable people just kind of either ignored me or they'd send me things saying, look, you've got to grow up and stop writing this kind of ridiculous stuff. But the thing that I kept seeing with the yield curve, let me go back to dynamic. In the spring of 2008, the yield curve had an inflection point. It did not. A technical inversion would happen when a yield on a longer instrument was lower than a yield on a shorter instrument. It floated just barely above that. In other words, I saw a yield here that was only like 5 basis points above a yield on a shorter term treasury instrument. It just kept floating there and floating there, month after day after day, week after week. And then one day, for a couple of hours, and it was just a couple of hours, a 10-year yield went below a 7-year yield. And I called, there's going to be a recession. It has to do it only once. If it does it once, that's all it takes. And it happened just for a few hours. And then about 5 days later, it did it again, just a few basis points. And sure enough, we had a recession, a hell of a recession. So it doesn't have to be some dramatic thing. But now, let me take you back to that dynamic chart that I was showing you before. Look. Let me take you back to here.
Do you see how there was a little bit more of a threat of an inversion there than there is here? You see it? A little bit more of a threat back there months ago than there was, than there is here. That's why the Fed, if you follow that kind of news and those kinds of things, the Federal Reserve early this year was talking about throwing out the hints and the side stories. Well, we're going to have to raise interest rates here pretty soon, blah, blah, blah. They kept talking about, well, it's coming, the interest rates are going to rise here. And then you haven't seen much about that at all in the last few months. That's because of that. The Fed realized that it's yakking and blabbing about bringing interest rates up, trying to claw back some of this massive liquidity they've been pouring in for the last 8 years, got the markets really spooked. And there, it was starting to drop toward an inversion. And so the Fed said, oh, the economy is still fragile. No problem with having interest rates where they are. No need to bring them up quite yet. And it went away. It's vanishing. But if you want to see where the economy is headed, keep an eye on a yield curve. They're in the dynamic charts has them. Wall Street Journal has them every day. They're just a very common thing, and they're a wonderful tool. So what that means for you personally is that at least for now, you have breathing room to go out and get your job before we have a recession. That's good news for you. The bad news is that sooner or later, the Fed's going to have to start talking about clawing back liquidity again. Now for the last thing, a formula. Today I'm going to do lump sums, forward and backward through time. And then on Thursday, I will do cash, streams of cash, annuities, forward and backward or through time. But let's look at this. The future value is the present value plus K to the T power. Now, this is the future value. This is the present value, what it's worth now, the money is. This is the periodic interest rate. In other words, the annual interest rate divided by the number of compoundings per year. And this is the number of periods, which is the number of years divided by the number of compoundings per year. Okay, now, let's try this. Okay, semi-annual. How many compoundings a year if I say semi-annual? Two, yes. Quarterly, monthly. Oh, I got to find a victim here. Yeah, okay. You're my victim. Daily. There you go, 365? No. But yes and no. It depends on whether you're a modern person or an old-fashioned person. So are you modern or are you old-fashioned? Okay, good. Fine. All this new age stuff, that's okay. You see, in the traditional way, you would use a 360 in the denominator and a 365 in the exponent. 360, in other words, you would divide the annual interest rate by 360. But for the number of years, you would multiply that by 365.
That was the old school way of doing it. And it actually made for a little more interest that way. 360 was ostensibly because there were 360 bankers' days in a year. The real reason was because there's an old, old trick I won't show you for dividing any number by 360 real fast. So before we had calculators and all that. But, so, for example, you found $100,000. You invest $100,000 at 6% compounded quarterly for 30 years. How much will you have at the end? So in other words, in the formula, you're going to have your present value is going to be $100,000, what it's worth now. Your K value is going to be 6% over quarterly 4, which, remember, 0.06, for God's sake, 0.06 over 4. God knows what that is. What is it? 1.5? 0.015? 0.015? I mean, you don't even do these. I mean, you put these in your calculator. Just run the calculation. Make sure you've got a scientific calculator, not a business calculator. But, T would be, what did I say? 30 years times 4 compoundings per year. So that's 120 periods. And you just flog it into your calculator. And if you do it right, I mean, you don't even have to do calculate the. I strongly recommend you don't, because you could get rounding error. Don't round until you have to, especially with the way those online things are. If I do this, okay, really? Calculator. So I'm going to just take it in, 100,000 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus, don't forget the 1 plus, 0.015 divided by, 0.06 divided by 4, close the parentheses, and raise it to the, you can put it in parentheses 30 times 4 if you want, or 120. Whoa! Try that again. To the 120th power times 100,000. 596,932. Yeah, 596,932.29. Is that what you got?
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. That's all there is to that part. Now, the other side of it. Ma'am, you're about 20, something like that. Okay. Suppose that you want to retire at 60 with $1 million. And we'd like to know how much you have to put in the bank right now to pull that trick. Well, in that case, we would want to flip this formula around. The present value is the future value over 1 plus k to the t power. Now, I do it this way. I do fv times 1 plus k to the negative t power, because the reciprocal is the same as the negative of the exponent. I just do it that way. It's a little bit cleaner than trying to use a denominator I always screw up parentheses and denominators, so I do it this way. Say that again.
$596,932.
I'm just testing you. 932.29. Oh, I see. I got confused there. Okay. Now, just really quickly, let's say 8% compounded monthly ...40 years. So in that case, the present value would be, we want to pull $1 million out of the bank. So we do 1 million times the quantity 1 plus 0.08 over 12 to the negative 40 times 12. That's how we do it. Don't forget parentheses, for heaven's sakes. But if I crank that one out, I would get 1 million. Great. 1 million times 1 plus 0.08 divided by 12, close the parentheses, to the what is that? That's 100 and, well, let me do it this way. 40 plus neg times 12, close the parentheses. I get, what do you get for an answer for that? Negative. Divided by 12. Clear. 1 plus 0.08 divided by 12 equals to the 40 times 12 pos neg, close parentheses, equals times 1, 2, 3, equal. Yeah, 41,000. 197.38. Just make sure you can do that calculation yourself before you step into those problems on the homework. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.